This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hi, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading the Fortune program with articles from Fortune and Forbes magazines. First, from Fortune magazine, Face-to-Face with Failure. Economic turmoil poses a daunting challenge to founders, balancing their startup's future with their own mental health. By Andy Dunn. Somewhere I heard that a startup doesn't fail when it fails. It fails when the founders give up. In this money is no longer free market, that begs two questions. When should founders give up? And how should those founders manage their psychology while seeking the answers to such a momentous question? I am facing this exact dilemma right now. My new consumer software startup has not gone particularly well by one sort of important measure, growth. It's been a 4-year grind to find some signal of product market fit, and we haven't found it yet. At one point, we had 12 people. Soon, it might just be my co-founder Jen Greenwood and me, at least until we rebuild in a more methodical way. It's been like panning for gold in a turbulent river. Sometimes the prize feels closer, other times farther away. Still other times it feels like we are drowning in aimlessness and exasperation. An identity crisis looms for any high achiever flirting with failure, and a calculation begins on the conflicting forces of sunk costs and lost time on the one hand, and reputational harm on the other. As entrepreneurs, we struggle to separate our egos from the prospects of our startups. We conflate the fate of the enterprise with our value as human beings. Our startup has burned through $10 million of cash, much of it our own. Were it not for the privilege of access to capital that comes from my being an exited founder, we'd have been dead in the water years ago. As Mark Andreessen warned me during a Zoom meeting in 2020, which did not lead to an investment, make sure you don't raise too much money or you'll be stuck working on this for a long time. Raise just enough to get to the milestones that justify the next raise. Oops. As an entrepreneur who loves fundraising, I kept Jedi mind-tricking myself into believing I'd achieved the milestones to raise more. Over last year's holiday, Jen and I took stock of where we were. Years of iteration, an exhausted team, and yet still $2 million left in the bank. Should we try to sell or merge with another startup or company? Should we return capital to our investors at 16 cents on the dollar? Or should we keep iterating, perhaps consider yet another pivot, even if it means we might run out of cash and end up with goose eggs for our investors, our team, and our time? According to Ken Chenault, the legendary former CEO of American Express and current chairman of venture firm General Catalyst, the job of a leader is to deliver on two sometimes conflicting mandates, creating hope and defining reality. The reason we call the entrepreneurial journey a roller coaster is because, as with so much of the human experience, hope can be a peak and reality can be the pits. My observation is that it is nearly impossible to be hopeful and realistic at the same time. To fulfill Chenault's mandate, some days I publicly project hope, usually when I am genuinely feeling optimistic. Other days I privately suffer the reality of things going nowhere, and then attempt to share just the right amount of the difficulty with the team. At my best, I offer enough of a dose of disinfecting sunlight to build trust through transparency, but not so much that doubt and demoralization run rampant. I don't want to lead those I'm leading to update their LinkedIn profiles. My roller coaster is amplified by an underlying mood disorder called Bipolar 1. I've shared my journey with the condition in a memoir and a subsequent TED Talk. For the first 9 years I spent building my previous startup, Bonobos, I was in denial that I had a mental illness. I assumed if people knew about my college diagnosis, I'd never be able to recruit a team or raise capital. In reality, there are droves of entrepreneurs with challenges like mine. According to a study from the University of California at San Francisco, neurodiversity correlates with entrepreneurial drive. Bipolar disorder might affect 2% of the adult population, but 11% of entrepreneurs, 5 times higher. That type of disproportionate representation is also seen for entrepreneurial leaders with depression, ADHD, generalized anxiety disorder, and substance use disorder. In some strange way, I process this fact as luck. The wake-up call I received when a manic episode landed me at Bellevue Hospital for a week and then in jail for a day catalyzed life changes that provide mental scaffolding I didn't have before. The foundations of my regimen look like this: 2 sessions with my psychiatrist every week, medication every day in lieu of self-medication with alcohol, 8 hours of sleep a night, with a verifying screenshot from my Whoop app sent every morning to my wife, doctor, mother, and sister. Building a company is a mentally unhealthy endeavor. It attracts folks with mental health issues, perhaps exacerbating them, and it may create mental health issues for others. Still, each of us, neurodivergent or not, has mental fitness to maintain. And while everyone is different, everyone needs a regimen. Whether that regimen entails meditation, medication, exercise, therapy, executive coaching, eating keto, morning sunlight, cold plunges, or just listening to Andrew Huberman podcasts on repeat, do it. If we don't secure our own oxygen masks, we're not going to be able to secure anyone else's either. The financial health of a company and the mental health of its founder often track together. For our last round of fundraising in the back half of 2022, venture capital was beginning to evaporate. In some ways, I deserved to be stymied. I hadn't proved that I could find a product that worked. To stay alive, I sought out a high net worth entrepreneur to lead a down round that enabled us to keep operating. I used to think down rounds spelled the end, but with the support of seasoned insiders like venture capitalists Kirsten Green and Jeremy Liu, who realized they'd rather own some of their stake for something rather than 100% of it for nothing, and with a rebooted equity pool for the team, a down round could be a new beginning. Sure enough, both Green and Liu invested more. Flat is the new up, and down is the new flat. The entrepreneur who led that round is precisely who I called this past December to get advice. Ev Williams, co-founder of Twitter and the founding CEO of Medium and Blogger, picked up the phone. I laid out my hopes and fears for him about where we were. He asked all the right skeptical questions about our metrics, our team's morale, and where I was. And at the end of the call, he delivered a judgment that was more upbeat than I expected. I wouldn't stop right now. Keep going. Keep going. Those words rang in my ears the rest of winter break. Jen and I made some tough decisions in the ensuing days. We planned to take the team down to the studs and rebuild from there. Some good people would be going part-time or leaving. At least 3 months of severance helped dull the blow, something we could do because we assessed the crisis that was coming before it became an actual crisis. We reduced burn by 2/3, deciding to focus on go-to-market rather than deepening our technical investments. With this renewed focus, we actually started growing at over 10% a week. We moved the headquarters of the company, and we went all in on one key product move and on one key market, Sweet Home Chicago. Things are picking up. Or are they? More aptly put, How long will it be before the roller coaster tops out and begins a new plunge? Hope springs eternal in the world of startups, because it has to. As we embarked on 2024, I resolved to microdose reality every day, rather than wallowing in the troughs, to make it possible to metabolize the hard stuff and stay more buoyant, more stoically and resiliently optimistic every day. Past need not be prologue. The truth is that we sometimes have a moral obligation to keep going, to our teams, to our customers, and to our shareholders. It's not always about what's best for us in the moment. The memories of having been through difficult times at Bonobos and having endured provide ballast. The lasting culture we built, the solid financial outcome, the fact that the brand has doubled in size since we sold it, it's all a reminder that it can be worth it. It calls to mind something that kept me going during darker days at Bonobos, when catatonic depression had me sometimes feeling like I didn't want to live. It was a book one of our first employees, Kevin Kelleher, gave me called Cowboy Ethics. One page had a photo of a cowboy on horseback getting pummeled by freezing rain. The caption reads, "When you're riding through hell, keep riding." Of course, in pop culture, cowboys are stoic loners who push their bodies and minds to the limit. They're not typically paragons of vulnerability. But in real life, we entrepreneurial cowboys and cowgirls need to take care of body and mind and ask for help when we need it. We also need to hold ourselves accountable for our own mental health and make sure we don't cause harm to others. Stick to that mentality, and you'll have the fuel you need, whichever way your company goes. And if you can, and if you should, keep going. Also from Fortune magazine, the unexpected upside of an aging workforce. Hiring and retaining older workers can help boost your company's bottom line. By Alexa Mikhail. The graying of the U.S. workforce is gaining momentum. A Pew Research survey found nearly a fifth of Americans age 65 and older were employed in 2023, nearly double the three decades prior. Employees 55 and older will constitute over a quarter of the global workforce by 2031, according to an analysis from Bain & Company last year. Finding ways to capitalize on an increasingly intergenerational workforce is top of mind for Jason LaRue, National Managing Partner of Talent and Culture at KPMG, who supports the firm's 36,000 U.S. partners and professionals. "We're absolutely going to have to be able to attract workers across a wide set of generations, including people who have had longer careers already," LaRue tells Fortune. "There's no magic about I turned X age and therefore I am capable or not capable of doing something else." This marks an unprecedented time for most workplaces, where the presence of retirement age workers used to be rare. However, given the current U.S. labor shortage, it could be a win-win for those older workers and their employers alike. As the pool of older workers grows, so does the evidence that their presence on multi-generational teams can boost a company's bottom line, foster innovation, and help combat widespread burnout. In the war for talent, employers must implement novel ways to integrate and engage both long-time and new cohorts of experienced workers. For practical and professional reasons, adults are working longer. For some, the financial impact of caregiving and the need for a steady paycheck to support their longer, healthier lifespans have made traditional retirement impossible. "We're having to try and invent a life that hasn't been lived before," says John Beard, director of the International Longevity Center, USA, and professor at the Robert N. Butler Columbia Aging Center. Other older Americans continue to work to maintain social connections, for a sense of purpose, or to reimagine a career in a novel decade of opportunity. Like Elizabeth White, author of 55, Underemployed, and Faking Normal. She joined a startup incubator at age 68 and became a founder at 70. I think that the days of retirement being a one-time, one-way exit and then you're done are over, she tells Fortune. While generations are not monoliths, research suggests older workers are the most loyal employees and tend to stay in their jobs longer. According to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, companies whose proportion of older workers is 10% higher than that of other firms see 4% less turnover compared with companies with a lower proportion. That may not seem like a big difference, but losing and replacing an employee can cost companies between 1 and 2 times the employee's annual salary. Older workers also possess what Bethany Iverson, co-founder of The Coven, a co-working space for underrepresented groups, calls crystallized intelligence. As we age, we get better at formalizing knowledge. We get better at giving advice and sharing feedback, she says. Dr. Linda Fried, director of Columbia's Age Boom Academy and the Robert N. Butler Columbia Aging Center and the dean of the Columbia Mailman School of Public Health, says older workers also possess more pro-social motivations, that is, an empathy and a desire to serve others. As people get older, maybe because of their problem-solving capabilities plus a huge dose of generativity, they want to leave things better for subsequent generations, Fried tells Fortune. Companies benefit from an older employee's desire to make improvements and help others avoid mistakes. Older workers may also be a solution to high burnout rates. Research suggests a fourth of the workforce faces burnout symptoms, such as feeling overwhelmed, anxious, or distressed, which can lead to high turnover and absenteeism, costing companies billions in lost productivity. But according to a 2022 survey from Gallup, baby boomers have the lowest levels of burnout and the highest engagement at work. Iverson hypothesizes older workers don't feel the pressure to climb the ladder as they did when they were younger. Not only are older workers less likely to leave, their calmer, more relaxed perspective can rub off on younger workers in an intergenerational workplace. Extensive research from the AARP found that teams composed of older and younger workers are more productive than homogeneous age groups. According to a 2020 International Longevity Center study in the UK, teams with an age range of 25 years or more met or exceeded management's expectations 73% of the time, compared with 35% for teams with an age gap of less than 10 years. Older workers are bringing a whole different layer of experience, a savvy ability to problem solve, that when you mix it with younger brackets, it produces a high amount of output, says Gary A. Officer, CEO of the Center for Workforce Inclusion. Despite the case for retention, many older workers don't feel supported in their growth once they reach the age society deems graying. A significant barrier to thriving at work is the ageist assumptions around older employees. Fried says the false assumption that older workers take jobs from younger ones, the lump of labor fallacy, propels ageism and creates barriers to age inclusivity. We're socialized to be ageist, she says, adding that older workers do not often compete with younger workers for the same job. A vast majority, 82% of workers between age 50 and 80, report experiencing at least one form of ageism in their daily lives, a University of Michigan poll found. 1 in 6 older adults says they haven't gotten a job because of their age, according to the AARP. 40% of employers do not have policies in place to support older workers, according to the Coven. We don't celebrate the expertise, the knowledge, and the wisdom in the ways that we should, Iverson says, of older workers. Over 1,000 companies have pledged to create equal opportunities for older workers as part of AARP's Employer Pledge program. While the pledge is a good start, Fried says putting age-inclusive policies and accommodations into action is most impactful. As standard retirements become a thing of the past, and many older workers hope to stay working, employers must rebut baked-in ageism and see their most tenured employees as assets. We are in a war for talent continually, and that war for talent gets lost, which has a direct effect on the bottom line if the people at your company don't feel like they belong, says Jessica Kriegel, the chief scientist of workplace culture at Culture Partners. Key Bullock, the vice president of talent acquisition at Northrop Grumman, which hires 10,000 employees a year, says its iReturn program has led to an 80% retention rate since 2017. The training and mentoring program is designed for mid to late career workers who have taken at least a 2-year career break and are looking to re-engage. Beyond hiring, LaRue says it's what happens within the closed doors of an office setting that dictates whether or not older workers feel seen. KPMG's caregiver concierge benefits target those who may be caring for an older parent, coupled with work responsibilities. Caregiving benefits, such as in-home aides, paid time off, and flexible work schedules, can scale beyond an employee's child to their aging parents, who are living longer and often lean on their adult children for support. As 90% of older workers say their job must feel meaningful to accept a position, employers have to find innovative ways to re-engage and support them. There's a massive opportunity to reimagine how roles are designed, helping organizations absorb the wisdom of older employees before they eventually transition out of the workforce, says Iverson. She envisions evolved roles capitalizing on older employees' crystallized intelligence, such as documentation positions, where people can synthesize their knowledge for future workers. It's great for the organization because when they do eventually retire or leave the workforce, there is an artifact of all the things that they were working on and that they were great at, Iverson says. Offering advisory, coaching, mentoring, or part-time roles can help retain older workers, Iverson adds, along with flexible working hours and remote options. Iverson also suggests asking older workers how they might imagine their role evolving to keep them as engaged and fulfilled as possible. Managers shouldn't assume that older employees have no interest in growing on the job. As we live longer, it's time to redefine what it means to work. How can that look different and create more fulfillment for individuals as they age while supporting companies? Working is no longer solely about climbing the ladder. Maybe it's also about making a lateral move, creating something new later in life, or pivoting completely. I get very excited about the social capital that older adults could bring, Fried says. This is astoundingly optimistic if we can take down our blinders and think about how to design for a society in which people can stay engaged. Next, from Forbes magazine, several short pieces from the World of Forbes column. Across the planet, our 42 licensed editions span 6 continents, 68 countries, and 30 languages. They all share the same mission, celebrating entrepreneurial capitalism in all its forms. Argentina. Past administrations exhausted Argentine's patience, writes Forbes Argentina, assessing how the economy gets back on track faster than immediately under new president Javier Milei, who took office in December. Australia. All the mistakes you make in life are school fees. It's a tough teacher because you get the test first and the lesson afterwards. According to Peter Friedman, the 65-year-old owner of Rode Microphones in Sydney, who took over his father's company, survived crippling debt, and recently acquired U.S. audio products maker Mackie for an estimated $200 million. Brazil. Forbes Brazil features Jojo Toninho on its 30 Under 30 list for her early success as a media influencer. The 26-year-old from Rio de Janeiro has amassed 28 million Instagram followers as a singer, TV personality, and cosmetics entrepreneur. Bulgaria. Forbes Bulgaria's 30 Under 30 issue features 29-year-old Plamen Nakov, founder of the information technology company DSS. After a contract freeze with oil giant BP in 2017, the Sofia-based software development and consulting business is now generating $3.6 million in revenue. China. Colin Guo, a partner at Hongshan, the new name for Sequoia Capital China, jumped 15 spots in a year to 12th place on Forbes China's ranking of the country's top 100 venture capitalists. His portfolio activity included a $500 million IPO for logistics company J&T Express last year. Czech Republic. Petr Šramek founded a longevity clinic with locations in Prague and Boca Raton, Florida, and has invested in the longevity sector. He predicts a boom starting next year as advancing technologies enable humans to routinely live to age 120. Ecuador. The dissolution of Ecuador's National Assembly by its former president last May prompted earlier than expected elections in the country. Now newly elected President Daniel Noboa, 36, and his cabinet aim to lower the crime rate and reduce unemployment by the end of his term in May 2025. France. Paris-based Danone is selling its two U.S. organic dairy brands, Horizon Organic and Wallaby, which represented about 3% of global sales. The food and beverage giant, rooted in yogurt, may now become more aggressive on acquisitions, refocusing its core growth products. Georgia. Forbes Georgia features the 100 largest private companies in the country, excluding the banking sector. Based on financial statements from 2021, these businesses had aggregate revenue of $10 billion, $1.8 billion of which was generated by oil sellers and distributors. Greece. After starting out as a wholesaler in 2005, Athens-based Funky Buddha expanded into retail and went from selling tees and shorts to a full collection. Now the company is venturing outside Greece with locations in Cyprus, Hungary, and soon, Saudi Arabia. That concludes this week's edition of the Fortune Program. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.
Hello, and welcome to readings from Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine, issue March 2024, read to you by Steve Malisi. How the Federal Reserve Works. The central bank has an outsized impact on financial markets. Eight times a year, a group of 19 bankers, finance experts, and economists gather for a two-day confab in an elegant cream and gold boardroom about a mile from the White House. After they're done analyzing the outlook for inflation and employment, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, the leader of the group known as the Federal Open Market Committee, emerges and announces what they have decided to set as a target range for short-term interest rates. The committee's goal, known as the dual mandate, is to set an interest rate that enables the economy to achieve price stability and full employment. It is enormously important to investors, savers, borrowers, and business leaders whether and how the Fed achieves this delicate balance. Books have been written on exactly how the Federal Reserve influences investment markets, but here's a quick and rough summary. The first thing is to understand is what the FOMC's vague-sounding goals actually mean. Fed officials have said they consider the economy to have price stability when a Department of Commerce calculation of U.S. consumer spending, called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, rises by 2% a year. Fed economists like the PCE price index because it considers how shoppers substitute, say, lower-cost chicken when beef prices rise, thus reflecting the prices consumers actually pay. That's one reason the PCE measure tends to run lower than the more widely cited consumer price index. As of December 2023, the CPI had risen 3.1% over the previous 12 months, while the PCE price index was up 2.6%. the Fed has not set a specific ideal full employment number. Instead, Fed officials say they look at a variety of measures, such as wage trends and the percentages of workers employed in different population groups, to aim for the maximum employment level that doesn't kick off wage inflation. The Fed's toolbox. The most powerful tool the Fed has to achieve those goals is the influence it has on short-term interest rates. When the FOMC announces its target range for the federal funds rate, it is indicating what it wants banks to charge each other for lending or borrowing cash overnight. But the Fed can't force banks to charge each other its chosen interest rate. Instead, it steers banks toward the targets by adjusting the interest rates it pays to and charges from banks for the reserves that banks are required to keep with the Fed and any overnight Fed loans to member banks. Maneuvering all of the nation's 4,600 banks to its ideal interest rate isn't an exact science, hence the target range for the federal funds rate, spanning roughly a quarter of a percentage point. As of December 31st, the range was between 5.25% and 5.5%. The federal funds rate is essentially a floor for all other interest rates in the economy. For example, the prime rate, which is the rate banks charge their best customers, is typically set 3 percentage points above the high end of the federal funds target rate. And the prime rate serves as a floor for many bank lending rates, including credit cards and auto loans. If inflation continues to moderate and the economy continues on its current steady trajectory, Powell said in December that the FOMC would aim to lower the midpoint of the federal funds target range to roughly 4.6% by the end of 2024 and 3.6% at the end of 2025. But almost immediately after his announcement, investors in the futures market started betting that the FOMC would start cutting the federal funds rate as soon as March and would drop the rate to 4% or below by year-end 2024. To influence long-term interest rates, the Fed has another strategy, managing the securities it keeps on its balance sheet. In an effort to lessen the pain of the 2008 Great Recession and later the COVID shutdowns, the Fed sought to drive down long-term interest rates by buying up trillions of dollars of treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. The massive purchases helped push bond prices higher and send yields, which move in the opposite direction, lower. The process, quantitative easing, helped drive interest rates on the 10-year treasury bond to as low as 0.55% in 2020. But as inflation took off, the Fed made a U-turn and, starting in 2022, strove instead to cool the economy by pushing up rates, raising borrowing costs. It switched to quantitative tightening, allowing some bonds in its portfolio to mature each month without replacing them, recently to the tune of $95 billion a month. By reducing its purchases, the Fed relied on lower demand to cool bond prices, allowing long-term rates to rise. The Fed has reduced the total value of securities on its balance sheet by $1 trillion to $7.7 trillion since March of 2023, and it has indicated it hopes to run off another $1 trillion in 2024. As quantitative tightening winds down, the Fed's influence on longer-term rates is diminishing. Prepare for landing. The market impact of Fed actions can be immediate. The recent announcement of a pivot from hiking to anticipated cutting was met with what some veteran Fed watchers worry is a bit of irrational exuberance, a phrase coined by former Fed chairman Alan Greenspan. A number of stock indexes hit new highs, and bonds rallied as investors cheered the possibility that the Federal Reserve had pulled off a difficult soft landing, raising interest rates enough to cut inflation without setting off a recession. This was a very thin needle to thread, because Federal Reserve interest rate hikes have caused most of the recessions in the past 50 years, says Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics. Barring a shock such as an energy price spike or worsening geopolitical hostilities, they may have pulled it off, he says. After the announcement, Jay Hatfield, chief executive officer of Infrastructure Capital Advisors, raised his forecasts for the S&P 500 from 5150 at year-end 2024 to 5500. We think both stocks and bonds are going to do really well in 2024, he says. Despite Wall Street's celebratory mood, however, it's important to note that the soft landing has not actually touched down yet, and that interest rates are notoriously difficult to predict. That's why many financial market strategists remain circumspect. Pramod Atluri, a fixed income portfolio manager for the Capital Group, is urging investors to start putting sidelined money to work, but favors high-quality fare such as treasuries and agency-backed mortgage bonds. As for stocks, Robert Almeida, a global investment strategist for MFS Investment Management, is focusing on higher-quality companies that can sustain profitability, no matter what the Fed does. Where kids can put their money. Give your child a head start by opening a bank, savings, or investment account. If your child has gift money from birthdays and holidays, or earnings from chores or a part-time job, you may be looking for somewhere to park the cash. And if your kid expects to work over the coming summer, it's not too early to think about where the money should go. Opening a bank or retirement account provides a secure way for children and teens to save money, and you can use it as an opportunity to share financial lessons with them as well. Consider these options. Set up a bank account. Opening a bank account is a valuable step in teaching children about financial responsibility, and it provides a safe place for them to put their money. If your child is going to focus primarily on saving, which is often most appropriate for younger kids, a standalone savings account without a linked checking account makes sense. However, if you're introducing an older child to responsible spending, a checking account can be a valuable tool. Whichever type of account you choose, you and your child will likely need to open it jointly. Because joint accounts offer shared access, they provide hands-on opportunity for kids to learn about money management. But you can monitor their transactions and set limits by asking the bank to restrict how much can be charged daily to an accompanying debit card, for example. The financial institution where you do your own banking is often a good place to start as you search for an account for your child. But you may want to explore other options too, including local banks and credit unions. Look for an account with a low or no minimum balance requirement and no monthly fee. That's typically most suitable for children who may not keep a large balance. You'll need to provide the bank with identification, such as social security numbers or birth certificates, for both you and your child. You can usually start the process online, but it might require a visit to a bank branch if you choose a brick-and-mortar institution. Some accounts are designed for young savers and spenders, offering educational resources, online tools that both parents and children can use, and minimal fees. For example, the online Capital One Kids Savings Account is a no-stress option with no minimum deposit or balance requirements and no fees. It recently offered a 2.5% yield. Capital One also offers the online Money Teen Checking Account, which allows teens, or any child 8 or older, to make purchases and withdraw cash with a debit card as well as deposit checks. But you and your child can track expenditures and receive account alerts by text message, and parents can set spending limits on the account and lock or unlock the debit card through the Capital One mobile app. The account has no monthly fee or minimum balance requirement, and ATM withdrawals are free at more than 70,000 in-network ATMs. Another option is the Alliant Credit Union Teen Checking Account, available to teens age 13 to 17. The no-fee, no-minimum account provides a debit card that has preset limits on purchases and ATM withdrawals, and adult joint owners have full access to the account. It reimburses up to $20 monthly in fees for out-of-network ATM transactions. The Alliant Kids Savings Account has no monthly fee and yields 3.1% if the balance is $100 or more. Alliant Credit Union is an online institution that offers membership to anyone nationwide who joins the Foster Care to Success charitable organization. Alliant pays the $5 membership fee on your behalf. Weigh the value of a prepaid card. A prepaid debit card is not linked to a bank account. Instead, you load money directly onto the card. Prepaid cards provide a hard limit on spending. You typically can't overdraw, as you sometimes can with a bank account. And that may be an attractive feature for families with kids who are learning the ropes of spending money. You can get prepaid cards online or in-store at major retailers such as Walmart or Target. Some prepaid cards are tailored for families with children. For instance, the Greenlight mobile app offers a prepaid debit card through three plans for families. Parents can set controls, view a transaction history, and, if needed, lock the card if it's lost or stolen. The app also has tools parents can use to set up chores and pay kids for them. Similarly, FamZoo is a prepaid debit card and app with educational features and a suite of money management tools for families. The downside? Many prepaid cards come with several fees, such as monthly fees, charges for certain types of transactions, or fees for loading funds. Greenlight charges a monthly membership fee ranging from $5 to $15, depending on the features you choose. FamZoo charges $6 monthly, or, if you prepay, $25 for 6 months, $40 for 12 months, and $60 for 24 months. If you think you and your child will benefit from the interactive features that a family-focused prepaid card offers, the monthly fee may be worthwhile. Otherwise, a no-fee bank account might be the best option. Or consider a standard prepaid card that keeps fees to a minimum. Bluebird by American Express, for example, has no monthly fee and charges no fees to add money by direct deposit or bank account transfer. Cash reloads at participating retailers cost up to $3.95. You can set up sub-accounts for kids 13 and older to access money on the card, and you control daily spending limits, the ability to withdraw from ATMs, and certain other account activity. Invest in the future with a Roth IRA. If your child has earned income from, say, a summer job, babysitting, or other part-time work, he or she is eligible to contribute to a custodial Roth IRA. Funding a Roth IRA can be an excellent way to introduce children to investing for retirement. And by starting early, they'll benefit from the many years of compounding interest. Opening a custodial Roth IRA for your child is simple. Major brokers such as Fidelity, Charles Schwab, and Vanguard offer them. You'll typically need your child's Social Security number as well as your own identification to open a Roth. You can contribute the lesser of the child's annual earned income or the yearly IRA contribution limit, which is $7,000 in 2024 for those younger than 50. If you'd like to direct some of your own savings toward your child's future, you can contribute to a Roth on a child's behalf, as long as your contribution falls within the limits. For example, if your child earned $1,000 for the year, you could fund the IRA with $1,000 of your money, and the child could use his or her earnings to save for other goals. Roth contributions are made with post-tax income, but the investments grow tax-free, and withdrawals during retirement are tax-free too. With a traditional IRA, contributions are pre-tax, and investments grow tax-deferred. But distributions in retirement are subject to income tax. Because children typically have low incomes and will likely be in a higher tax bracket by the time they retire, the immediate tax benefit that a traditional IRA offers is usually less valuable for kids than the delayed tax benefit that a Roth IRA provides. Additionally, withdrawals of Roth IRA contributions are free of penalty and taxes anytime. Withdrawals of investment earnings before age 59 and a half are typically subject to taxes and penalties. which may be helpful to your child in a financial emergency. And those younger than 59.5 who have had a Roth for at least 5 years pay no tax or penalty on up to $10,000 withdrawn to pay for a first-time home purchase. Why you should consider disability insurance. If illness or injury leaves you unable to work, a policy could be a financial lifeline. As of 2021, according to the Census Bureau, 12% of workers in their prime earning years, ages 35 to 64, were disabled. At the same time, nearly one-fourth of Americans have no emergency savings, according to a survey by Bankrate.com. While the Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, program provides benefits for individuals who meet its criteria for disability, the application process is often long. Many applicants are rejected, and benefits are modest, an estimated monthly average of $1,537 in 2024. Disability insurance is the most effective way to protect you and your family if you are unable to work. If your employer offers long-term disability insurance, you may be able to obtain a policy that covers about 60% of your income for 5 years or longer, according to the Insurance Information Institute. You typically apply during open enrollment, and because the policies are usually offered as part of a group plan, you probably won't have to take a medical exam to qualify, an important consideration if you have health issues. Most employers cover the premium, but you'll likely have to pay taxes on disability payments. Although employer insurance is helpful, it may not provide sufficient coverage to pay your bills if you're out of work, and you'll likely lose the insurance if you change jobs. An individual policy can fill in the gaps, and if you don't have access to a workplace disability policy, you'll need to buy one on your own. Find the right policy. You can shop for disability insurance policies at www.policygenius.com or work with an independent insurance agent. Look for a policy that's best suited to your lifestyle and that offers the option of adding coverage if your circumstances change. For example, if you have a family, you may want more coverage than a single person. Disability policies typically provide short-term or long-term coverage. Short-term insurance is intended to cover from 40% to 70% of your salary for 3 to 6 months, or until you're able to return to work, whichever comes first. The cost can be as low as $10 a month. A long-term policy should last for years, potentially until you reach retirement age. It will typically replace 60 to 80% of your income if you're unable to work. Prices vary depending on your income, but the average cost can run as high as $250 a month. Premium costs will depend not only on length of coverage, but also on your job, age, and gender. If you're younger than 40 and work in a low-risk occupation, premiums may be based on 1% to 3% of your income. If you're 40 or older or work in a high-risk physical job, premiums could cost 5 to 7% of your salary. Women may be charged higher premiums because they tend to file more claims. The type of coverage matters too, especially if you have a highly specialized job. T. Eric Reich, a certified financial planner and founder of Reich Asset Management, advocates buying an own occupation policy. These policies typically have higher premiums, but they help you maintain your standard of living if you're unable to perform specialized tasks associated with your occupation. If you're a skilled surgeon, for example, an own occupation policy will provide coverage if you're unable to perform surgery, even if you could perform another type of job. Any occupation policy will provide benefits only if you're unable to work at all. When comparing policies, focus on what will provide the most protection for you and your loved ones. The ability to work and earn income is your most important asset, Reich says. Opening the door to professional growth. This nonprofit connects people with underserved communities with jobs that offer the potential for advancement. Arthur Langer, chairman and founder of Workforce Opportunity Services, professor of Professorial Practice at Columbia University in New York City. What is the mission of Workforce Opportunity Services? Langer. Our mission is to create a systemic flow of untapped talent into the workforce. We work with companies to find out their needs and wants when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we look for individuals in underserved communities, including people of color and first-generation college graduates, to fill open positions that our clients have. We also support veterans who enlisted after 9/11. How do you assist individuals as they transition into jobs? As we train people, we employ them ourselves, and they work for clients in our managed service centers or on-site at client offices. Or, in many cases, today, they work remotely. During their employment with WOS, we offer various types of financial support, such as providing transportation, fixing their cars, or, in some cases, helping with their rent payments. We also fully cover the premium for individual health insurance, and for those who don't have a degree, we pay 100% of expenses for tuition, books, and travel for them to attend college classes part-time. For those who already have a college degree and have student loan debt, we give them some money to make their monthly payments while they're with us. For our clients, we do background checks and drug testing to ensure we meet business requirements. It's basically a try before you buy scenario for them. After working with these individuals through us for a while, usually about 9 months to a year, companies may choose to hire them free of any conversion charge. How do you find people to employ? People can apply for positions on our website, and we hold open houses and free training sessions to recruit talent in more than 60 locations around the U.S. We're doing some international work, too. It's competitive because we're looking for the right people who fit the right opportunities. What kind of skills training do you provide? We run the gamut from web programming to welding to service desk support. We've also trained people to be plant managers, mechanics, and call center workers. We want people to grow in their jobs. They could eventually become supervisors and managers. Or with call center workers, for example, we may have them do that job for a short time and then retrain them in another area so they can keep progressing. What inspired you to start the organization? I was a poor kid from the Bronx. When I was in middle school, I took art lessons from a high school teacher named Mr. Ness, who volunteered to do art education at Saks Quality Stores in the Bronx. He told me that I had a lot of talent and suggested that I apply to a couple of high schools that specialized in the arts. He helped me build a portfolio, and I ended up going to the High School of Music and Art in Manhattan. Without Mr. Ness, I probably wouldn't be where I am today because going to that school exposed me to a broader group of people than I otherwise would have met. He showed me that one person can change the trajectory of your life. He didn't do the work, but the analogy I use is that he was my offensive lineman who blocks and tackles and creates openings. At WOS, we are the offensive line for the people we help. Older Americans are working longer and earning more. The percentage of American workers aged 65 and older has risen sharply since the 1980s. Their earning power has increased too. According to a report from the Pew Research Center, about 20% of Americans aged 65 and older were working in 2023, nearly double the percentage 35 years ago. The report also found that older workers' earnings have outpaced those of their younger counterparts. In 2022, the typical worker 65 or older earned $22 per hour, up from $13 in 1987. Older workers are also putting in more hours than in the past. Nearly two-thirds are working full-time, compared with 47% in 1987. Working longer is one of the most effective ways to lower the risk of running out of money in retirement because it reduces the number of years you'll need to finance with withdrawals from your nest egg. It also allows you to contribute more for retirement. Plus, if you are earning income from work, you may be able to delay filing for Social Security benefits, which will increase your monthly payouts when you file a claim. Americans born after 1955 aren't eligible for full retirement benefits until age 66, and full retirement age will gradually increase to 67 for those born in 1960 or later. And this has been Readings from Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day.